You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative minds behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Peter Sellers is backstage at Lyric.
The reason Dr. Atomic doesn't end with a big flash and finale is that there is no finale, is that the nuclear age is not over. We are still living in it. We are still living in the same world that those characters entered at 4 a.m. on July 16th, 1945, when the atomic age was born.
This is Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and I'm pleased to introduce the first episode in our Dr. Atomic podcast series. Your host for this series is Wynn Delacoma, who's currently an adjunct faculty member at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism and former music critic of the Chicago Sun-Times. Wynn will be interviewing a number of fascinating people associated with our production of Dr. Atomic, including the celebrated director-librettist Peter Sellers, in this first episode. Dr. Atomic premiered only 2 years ago. It's the latest example of composer John Adams's ongoing collaboration with Peter Sellers. It's an opera in which scientific achievements collide with unfathomable moral issues. We're in Los Alamos, New Mexico, in 1945, with scientists working feverishly on the government's top-secret Manhattan Project, the development and detonation of the first A-bomb. The brilliant physicists are grappling with incomprehensible responsibility, unleashing the most fearsome weapon humanity has ever known. The characters in the opera are real, as are the consequences brought about by the development of the atomic bomb. Now, on to the interview with Wynn Delacoma and Peter Sellers. I hope you enjoy it.
I'm here with Peter Sellers, who's the director of Dr. Atomic and also the author of the libretto. You and John Adams have worked together for, I think it's almost two decades now, Nixon in China in 87 and then Death of Klinghoffer, among other works. How did this project come about, Dr. Atomic?
Well, John Adams proposed it, and I think what happened was Pamela Rosenberg at the San Francisco Opera was making a season of Faust operas. And her idea was the Faust of the 20th century was Robert Oppenheimer. And so she proposed an opera about Robert Oppenheimer to John Adams. And of course, he lives in the Bay Area. And the idea of being able to write an opera and not leave home was very, very, very tempting. Meanwhile, we got involved actually with Alice Goodman to write the libretto, who had written the librettos for Nixon in China and Klinghoffer. And ultimately, she was unable to complete it. In any case, there was a fantastic and memorable meeting in Pamela Rosenberg's office at the San Francisco Opera where Alice said to Pamela, at the end of Faust, Faust loses his immortal soul, whereas at the end of Robert Oppenheimer's life, he realizes that he has an immortal soul. And so they're actually very different stories. And this is a story that doesn't end with damnation, but in fact has an amazing potential for hope and redemption. And so I was involved very much in the research part of it, as I always am with these operas, and constantly sending to Alice, you know, different transcripts from the written record, in this case, a lot of recently declassified documents where what people actually said and did is right there. And then, of course, you know, all these historical accounts. And I would underline this sentence or say, by the way, notice this person's doing that. And, you know, and I did that for almost 2 years. And then when Alice had to withdraw, I realized, actually, I had all the material. And in this case, we didn't have to make anything up. And we could make a libretto out of things that people actually said and did, except, of course, for one thing, which is that this is art. And art is more than television. It needs to not just be documentary. It needs to also have a poetic dimension of imagination and possibility. You know, Aristotle said, you know, poetry is more interesting than history because history is about what happened and poetry is about what might happen. And so this other place of opening. The other thing, of course, was that for the female characters, you know, what men said in 1945 was always written down and or surveilled and accounted for. What women said does not appear on any public record.
Let me ask you, how did you give shape to this, though? I mean, there is poetry certainly in the situation of the damnation of the soul and whatever, but how do you make a three-hour opera that people can follow and want to come back for at intermission?
Well, this is, of course, one of the issues is – and also how do the women speak? Mm-hmm. And so I needed a poetic voice, and I found that in Muriel Rukeyser, whose poetry is now being revisited. And if you wanted to say, well, what is an intelligent American woman thinking in the 40s, where do you go to find that out? Well, Muriel's poetry has this fantastic combination of plain speaking, kind of bold, and an amazing arch of emotion and imagination, and again, scientifically informed and aware and curious. And the courage of living is what her poetry is about. And so it goes right up against this atom bomb, this prospect for death, mass death, and kind of one of the darkest hours in the history of humanity. She shines a very bright light that goes right next to that darkness.
Let me ask you how the opera has changed in the 2 years since it had its world premiere in San Francisco. There's been a production in Amsterdam and, of course, now the one coming up at Lyric, and I know there are others in the works. How does that work? Do you look at a piece and say, this needs changing, that needs changing?
Well, you know, an opera is something you live with. You know, the beautiful thing about classical music, the word classical means that you live your whole life with something. You know, it's that your way you hear a Mozart symphony when you're, you know, 15 is different from how you hear it when you're 35 and different from how you hear it when you're 65. You know, these, you can actually measure your own life by these pieces. And your shifting response to these pieces is actually the way are markers in your own life. Of course, living with this piece is quite an experience. I mean, it's astonishing to be present at the creation because, you know, the birth of the new baby is, of course, overwhelming to everybody involved. And you have the world's most beautiful baby pictures. Of course, you're sure. but what's wonderful is, that, of course, needless to say, getting to know the child as it grows up and actually acquires its own language and possibility for self-expression and personality. And you begin to know who this person is. So what's great is as the work itself comes to tell us about itself, we learn a lot. And you'll see in Chicago a very different production from what was there in San Francisco. Musically, things are much tauter, and John has rewritten two new episodes. We've trimmed a couple of little things, and in fact, the opera's ending and beginning are both new. Yeah. And as well, he's taken the role of Kitty Oppenheimer that was originally set for mezzo and recast it for soprano, high, ringing, glorious, blazing, light-filled sound to go up against all of this intense, murky, Wagnerian baritones and bassos who are plotting the destruction of the planet.
Batter my heart. Thank you.
There are dance elements in this, too. Dance is very important in this opera. Can you tell me why that is, why you think that's important?
Yes, I think dance is a very important part of opera because opera is about the gathering of all the art forms. Opera is this interdisciplinary shared space where you see people with different skills, different technical and disciplinary levels of awareness and imagination all meet and share. Mm-hmm. And you see many languages spoken, you know, and I love that about opera. And so for me, the multiplicity of art forms is extremely important to the democratic promise of opera, which is as many voices as possible in harmony, and where the multiplication of voices doesn't diminish the truth but actually gives dimension to the truth. And so Nixon in China has dance, of course, with Mark Morris, as did Death of Klinghoffer. And I'm dance obsessed. Here, it's wonderful that Lucinda Childs has stepped forward to work with us. Lucinda and John had a collaboration early on, and I love that Lucinda and John made a very specific American language, what was called minimalism at the time. And to me, it connected with the kind of another era in the history of art, which is the 1940s, where not only did America, you know, make an atomic bomb that changed the world and created a new language, but also was making art that did the same. The abstract expressionists and, of course, Martha Graham and Noguchi. And what you see on stage is very much a set of pared down Martha Graham Noguchi images. In fact, the set is quite Japanese. And this implication that the leading American artists in the 40s were influenced by Japanese art.
Yeah, amazing.
You know, and you actually, so before Hiroshima, you actually have a very, very profound Japanese influence, which is creating modern American art, which in turn changed art all over the world.
I think a lot of people expect that opera is going to be about dead princesses or mythical figures, and you and John turned to the headlines. Why?
What could be more mythological than Richard Nixon or Mao Zedong? What could be more mythological than the atom bomb? You know, these things have become the myths that we live with. And they have mythic scale, mythic scope, mythic proportion. And so opera is the way to treat them. Also, though, I think what we are constantly in the midst of is a time where history is on fast forward and where we are inundated with mediatized versions of history, which are history a soundbite, you know, with actually all of the dimensionality stripped away. And these kind of flat propagandistic statements, you know, period, end of discussion. And you want to say, excuse me, we have such an impoverished sense of the history of our own lifetimes. What will it take to actually open up the very history we're living with and insist that, of course, there are more layers than we're being told or even being allowed to discuss? And so, you know, something like Hiroshima remains, you know, absolutely forbidden topic. You know, the Smithsonian was nearly dismantled because they tried to put on an exhibit about the Enola Gay, the plane that actually dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. I mean, it's incredible how we are still in denial about the deepest and most present facts of our own history. So it takes music to unlock the sealed chamber.
You had said at one point, though, that you would not want to do an opera about Hiroshima or the Holocaust or whatever, and now you're doing one about the A-bomb. How has your feeling changed?
Well, Hiroshima is not on stage. I think for me, one of the most powerful things is that we don't show it. And the entire opera happens on one night, which is the first test of the first bomb in Alamogordo in mid-July, a month before the bomb is dropped. Well, 3 weeks. And dramatically, what's very powerful about most of our works is, like Nixon in China, is Nixon before Watergate. The whole audience knows that Watergate is coming, but the people on stage don't. By having the whole audience know that Hiroshima is coming, but the people on stage at this first atomic bomb test don't know that. They don't know what will happen next. We do. So it's like watching a Greek tragedy in which exactly because you know how it ends, the drama is so intense because you're watching the characters not understand fully what they're in the middle of. Mm-hmm. And we're constantly doing what rarely happens in the American media, which is not to discuss effects but to discuss causes. We know what the effects were. Mm-hmm. Now, what were the causes? How did all this start out? What did people think they were doing? What were people wrestling with on the way to what we know happened? Let's go back and look at what they thought they were doing. And that's very empowering because, you know, America tends to react instead of think proactively. Mm-hmm. And that's politically very disempowering. You know, what happens is some kid is involved in a gang crime and is arrested and is put in prison for the rest of their life. That's not a very effective intervention. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously what would be more helpful is to figure out before it happens how you could have intervened positively and not had to go through that. What was the alternative? Were there alternatives? Art is always about making an alternative available and saying this is not inevitable. In fact, there are alternatives. Could we explore them?
Theater as well as opera. Can you tell me the differences and what there is about opera that keeps drawing you back to it, or what is unique about opera in terms of putting something on stage?
Theater is, of course, about this amazing sense of discovery and encounter that's happening on a nightly basis, and you never know how it's going to work out. And at any given moment in theater, you know, one scene sizzles and takes off, and then the next night that scene, nothing happens. And the scene sizzles and takes off is some other scene. You know, and every night theater is so different. No two performances are alike at all. Whereas opera, there's a lot at stake in the trains running on time. You know, it's highly organized for a reason. And therefore what happens is the kind of deep contemplation that happens in, like when you're seeing a painting in a museum, where it's organized, it's highly crafted, and because the spaciousness provided by music means that things happen, they take more time than it would take if you were just talking. Mm-hmm. That spaciousness provides a contemplative atmosphere and a place where the emotion is immediate, but then also something goes beyond the immediate and takes you into some deeper place of further feeling and maybe even imagination. And so for me, the spaciousness of the mirror of opera means you can look longer and deeper and maybe with another type of insight.
Let me ask you about Dr. Atomic in terms of the response of the audience. Do you think people are beginning to think about these things? Do you get a sense that when they walk out of the theater that they're maybe thinking about American history in a different way, or at least thinking about it at all?
Well, what it does do is invite people to think. You can't walk out of the theater and not think. What it doesn't do is tell you what to think. You know, to me that's propaganda, and that's exactly what we don't do, is everybody has this spaciousness in which they can find their own path and their arrive at their own conclusions. And that's a very important part of art, is that you're the only person who holds the key to your understanding of the piece. You asked me, you know, why opera and why would you do this in opera? And I would just mention that opera does have a wonderful history of dealing with the end of the world. And here we are right now living with the capacity to destroy the planet in a way no previous generation ever, ever could even imagine. And for Wagner, it could be an image, it could be an archetype. For us, it's a reality. And the reason Dr. Atomic doesn't end with a big flash and finale is that there is no finale, is that the nuclear age is not over. We are still living in it. We are still living in the same world that those characters entered at 4 a.m. on July 16th, 1945, when the atomic age was born. We are still living in that age. Now, it is deeply my hope that our children will live in a post-nuclear age. But at the moment, we are still living in a nuclear age, which is why the strange ticking and waiting that you hear at the end of Dr. Atomic, where time is suspended and where 1945 stretches into 2007 and 2008, is that that clock is still ticking. And hopefully we will be the generation that resets it. But let me just say that this capacity to destroy the world is not an image for the people on Earth right now. It is a reality, and we have to talk about it, and we have to deal with it. And I hope that with Dr. Atomic, art is playing its part.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features interviews with the creative forces behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.